Hello, and welcome to Community Conversations. These are pre-recorded interviews brought to you each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. on KRFY. Because of ongoing concerns about the COVID pandemic, we are not able to be in the studio doing live broadcast interviews right now. But we are still dedicated to recording and bringing to you topics of local and current interest, highlighting voices from our community. For Community Conversations, we are using phones and web-based technology so that participants can be recorded remotely. Please bear with us if there are any gaps or hiccups that might be caused by a slow or unstable phone or internet connection. Also, keep in mind that because these interviews are recorded, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that you hear it broadcast. Thank you for joining us for today's Community Conversation on KRFY 88.5 FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. Now grab a cup of coffee, sit back and enjoy some more of Adventure Number 8 by Jim Chappelle, and then we'll get on with today's show. Another edition of Community Conversations with your host this morning. I'm Phil Huff and joined by my co-host, Julie Calamine. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Phil. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. You know, Phil, the last time we met for our last Community Conversations, I was talking about packing up my backpack and leaving the Mount Lakes and moving toward mushrooming and things down in the lowland. And today, as I look out at the snow falling, I'm thinking about chopping wood and maybe making some soup.
Yeah.
It's changed a bunch.
And of course, being North Idaho, since we're recording this several days ahead, one never knows. It might be sunshiny and fly fishing weather again, although my guess is we're sliding into winter. This does have a lot of my skiing friends tuning up the skis and showing photos of their favorite area of the dusting of snow on top. And yeah, we're getting excited for winter, aren't we?
I think we are. Lots of fun things to think about with winter coming. And that does lend to an introduction of our topic today. Phil, you and I are going to be talking about Public Lands 101 with a gal named Holly Weiler. She is the Eastern Washington Regional Coordinator, Washington Trails Association, and she's also a writer for Out There magazine. Hello, Holly.
Hello.
Good morning, Holly. And I've known, for the interest of full disclosure, Holly for years, and I know her as one of the more adventuresome hikers around.
Well, she'll need to be for this week because it's snowing everywhere. But of course, we have other things we can do in public lands. But Phil and I have been thinking about this topic because we interview so many people that are active in the outdoors, and we're all over on public lands. There's so many types and so many uses and very different permissions and, you know, just information about each of these lands. So we thought we'd bring in someone who knows a little more about it than, at least than I do, maybe not more than you, Phil. So Holly, it's so great to have you join us. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, and how you became interested in the outdoors, and then how you came to be working for Washington Trails Association.
So I grew up in what I guess I could call an outdoorsy family, although we were the type of outdoorsy where we did a lot of, like my dad and brother, definitely really into hunting and fishing. And I started out doing a little hunting and fishing with them. and eventually reached the point where I didn't understand why I was only going out into the woods for the month of October and maybe into early November. I loved it out there. I wanted to explore a little bit more, spend more time in the woods. And then around that same time, I also became really involved with cross-country running, which I did through high school and through college. And when I finished running at the collegiate level, I took up trail running and I really started to explore my public lands. It seemed like the best way to continue my love of running, but also do some exploring a little bit farther from the trailhead. And over the years, that eventually transitioned into curiosity about what happened if I spent the night out instead of coming back at the end of my run. And so then I started hiking and backpacking. I joined the Spokane Mountaineers in probably the early 2000s. And as I became more and more involved with the Spokane Mountaineers, I started leading hikes for the club and leading backpacking trips. And as a club leader, that's when it became really important to start to research the areas that I was exploring, making sure that if I was going to put together a club event, that I was following the rules and regulations of the land manager. And so it was really through my backpacking that I started to learn some of the intricacies of the different public lands and what's allowed in which locations to make sure that I was following the rules. And then eventually I became really interested in writing. I started out as a high school English teacher, and in around 2014, 2015 or so, I decided that I was ready to transition into more serious writing. And so I actually applied to and was accepted in Eastern Washington University's Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing program. And around that same time, I started writing for Out There magazine. So I am typically doing Hike of the Month for each issue of Out There. And then occasionally I do other articles as assigned. And it was in the summer in between my 2 years of grad school that a position opened up for Washington Trails Association in Eastern Washington. And I'd been a longtime volunteer with WTA. I'd written some articles for the magazine. I'd done some writing for the website. And I'd done a little bit of trail work, not a ton of it. But I was really interested in trail work and wanted to become more involved. And so I knew I'd be mad at myself if I didn't apply, and I applied and I got the position. And so I've been working for WTA ever since. So yeah, it's a little bit of my background in outdoor and in recreation.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful story, and it's a great example of how recreationists who spend so much time on our public lands become not only sometimes the best advocates and stewards, but they have the best understanding of what it means to be on a certain parcel. And hopefully they've done their research so they know what to do well. And you know, reflecting on my own experience, our longtime listeners will know that my wife and I have hiked the Triple Crown, the Appalachian Trail, Pacific Crest, and Continental Divide. I think we've been on almost every jurisdiction from city, county, state to every unit of the federal land management agencies and all variations in between. And so it's a wonderful primer hiking across them to learn how they're managed, what you can do, what you can't do, who else you might see. It's one of those hands-on, actually get out there and experience it rather than learn it through a textbook type situations.
That's true. Phil, I was going to ask the question, does anyone have an idea of how many U.S. or state or local agencies own public lands? And I don't know if anyone has an idea of that. Do you, Holly, or you, Phil?
Well, I did a little research into this one. I was curious as well. So federally, there are 640 million acres of public land, so federal public lands. So that's just counting National Park Service, U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, those types of lands. And that makes up 28% of U.S. lands that are available in public ownership. And then I decided to dig into it a little bit just to see how it breaks down for the local region. And so actually Idaho, of our local states, has the highest number or highest percentage of public lands, with 70.4% of Idaho publicly owned, which ranks it number 4 out of the 50 states. Washington has ranked number 11 with 41.9% public lands, and Montana ranks 12th with 37.5%. But I think that the interesting thing too is to look at it on like the further breakdown, because I mean, particularly for me, and I live in Spokane County, I live in a rural part of Spokane County. So I have access to the outdoors right on my doorstep, but it's agricultural land around me. So even though 41.9% of Washington is publicly owned, Spokane County only has 10% in public ownership. And so it's also interesting to look at what's accessible right in my own backyard versus what do I have to travel to go and enjoy.
Yeah, so that's actually an interesting question, Julie, and on a federal level, it's a fairly straightforward answer. In terms of public lands, there's 4 major agencies that manage public lands or lands for the public trust. The U.S. Forest Service, which is under the Department of Agriculture. And we'll come back to each of them a little bit what their goals are throughout the conversation. The National Park Service, which operates under the Department of Interior, and has its own set of objectives. The Bureau of Land Management, which operates under the Department of Interior, and has a different set of objectives than the Park Service. And then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They manage the wildlife refuges. There is another manager of lands, but they are typically not public, and that's the Department of Defense. But as John Q. Public, you can't usually wander onto those. However, they do form or comprise a certain segment of government or federal lands. And you sometimes see them inside of those statistics that Holly just mentioned. On a state level, pretty much every state operates a little differently. And so it's really hard to put a finger on that without getting into some long, wonky explanations and details. But suffice it to say that most every state has something akin to what Idaho has, which has lands that are managed by the state for economic purposes, and then lands that are managed for recreation purposes. And they're oftentimes different units. Counties, again, oftentimes have their own lands. They vary county by county. We have over 3,000 counties in the United States, and there are some notable ones in terms of what they do. Maricopa County in Arizona has the largest county park system of any of those, I think, totaling a bit over 120,000 acres just in the county. And then counties closer to home, we're blessed with some really wonderful lands that are managed, for instance, in Bonner County.
Yeah, it varies wildly, doesn't it? Not so much from federal or state to state, but with the local lands, it can vary quite a bit. And it was like that in Minnesota, and you've explained Arizona. So there's a lot to know and a lot we need to know before we step onto the public land, sometimes with our pets, sometimes by ourselves, whatever we're planning on doing. So question is, why should we care about the distinctions? Are you going to get in trouble if you do the wrong thing on a public land, Holly?
Well, I mean, I'm a rule follower, so even if I don't get in trouble, it's important for me to know what's allowed and where. I had an interesting experience earlier this week where I really wanted to go to Finch Arboretum in Spokane to see the fall colors. And I completely did not even think about how I needed to make sure I looked it up ahead of time. I brought my dog with me. Dogs are not allowed at Finch Arboretum. And I had no idea. I've been there in the past and I thought that I remember seeing dogs there. And so I don't know if the rules have changed or if it's a rule that other people weren't following at the time. But I got to the parking lot, saw the signs that dogs were not allowed, and had to pick a backup plan on the spot. And so I guess that's just one example of distinctions where there are a lot of places where you can't take your dog, you might not be able to ride your bicycle, might not be able to ride your horse. Hunting and fishing may or may not be allowed, depending. And so those are all things that either we need to research in advance if we're a recreational user, or do like what I did, which was look up a secondary location on the spot and figure out a place where I could legally do what I intended to do that day.
Yeah, that's absolutely absolutely right. Research is the key to it all. Knowing the particular regulations for the particular place you're going are vital to having an enjoyable experience. That said, there are some broad stroke generalizations. We look at the National Park Service. It was established to combine elements of preservation along with elements of recreation and visitor interest. Typically in national parks, they're regulated in such a way that you can hike on trails, but going off trail into the backcountry is more highly regulated in terms of where you can camp, what kind of permits you need, whether or not there's a fee involved. The Park Service is relatively tightly regulated, oftentimes almost always no dogs, oftentimes almost always no hunting. The National Forest Service, on the other hand, again, with caveats, there are exceptions to this. Generally, there's no fee unless there's facilities involved. The permits are often quite less unless there's high use. You can almost always hike off trail, camp in a dispersed fashion. Hunting is almost always allowed. There's just far fewer restrictions and a greater sense of dispersion amongst what you can do. Again, with the caveat, know the unit you're going to. Counties and municipalities and states get into their own complex set of regulations that are oftentimes more restrictive for one or more classes of use.
Yeah, it seems so. Question for you, Phil, or maybe for Holly, just a little history on public lands. Are land, public lands part of the U.S. Constitution, or did they just come along later as presidents decided we needed to set land aside?
That's a great question, and Holly, unless you want to take it, I've actually spent a lot of time with that question. In fact, I'm reading a really great book right now by one of my favorite authors, H.W. Brands, called El Dorado, and it's a history of the American West. If you like history, you like the American West. It's a fantastic book. And of course, you can't talk about the history of the American West without talking about public lands. And the question you raise is a topic that's addressed not only in this book, but in many areas of conservation. When the Constitution came about, you'll want to remember that we had 13 colonies that came together to form a government that each had been granted land by England. And so they had claims over it and had a history of almost 200 years of managing it. There was really no such thing as federal land at that time. There was state land. Now, there was in the Constitution provisions by which the federal government could acquire land and manage those pieces of property. Then in 1803, President Jefferson did something really dramatic. He bought Louisiana from the French and all of a sudden doubled the size of our nation, and all of that new land was owned by the federal government. There were no states involved in the Louisiana Purchase. So now you had a really different vision of what our land was like. So almost everything west of the Mississippi derived first from lands that were federally bought and managed. As states became territories, as areas became territories and territories became state, then some of those lands were allocated to the state for their use, and some of it over time has been opened up through various means, through privatization. So we're left with a network today of lands that have been settled by individuals, have been acquired by the states, or have remained under federal jurisdiction in the public trust, our public lands, and they're the ones that we find involved in each of the agencies we mentioned earlier. They each have different mandates on how to use them. The Forest Service being created in some cases before statehood, or managing lands that were created for statehood, manages them for the greatest good for everyone. So they balance that need for economy, for mining, for timber production, for recreation. The Park Service manages it for the visitor experience of national wonders. The Bureau of Land Management is often controlling it for grazing and other uses with recreation as an afterthought. And the Fish and Wildlife Service, their refuges were created in large part to conserve resources for hunters and to open up hunting opportunities very specifically. And so they all have different objectives that have evolved over time.
And it's interesting because it really is different in the West than the East. We have such expansive federal land and also some state land that makes it just such a different experience than on the Eastern side.
We do have some state lands in the East. Most of the national forests that exist in the East have been purchased by the federal government.
for lack of payment of back taxes. The government was granted that authority in 1910 under the Weeks Act, and this is where we can get real wonky real quick. But suffice it to say that we have acquired millions of acres of land in the East in some really interesting, significant areas for recreation. The whole chain of the Appalachian Mountains, where the Appalachian Trail goes through, is protected by a system of national forests and national parks. And then you have a real interesting anomaly in Texas, a large chunk of the West. But you'll need to remember, Texas wasn't included in the Louisiana Purchase. It was its own republic. And so its system of land allocation came through original Spanish then Mexican land grants. And so you find fewer federal lands in Texas as a result of the fact that it was its own republic before being admitted into the U.S.
Yeah, you know, Phil, you've partially answered this question. Are we making more public lands? And I think the answer is yes, but not to the degree that we once did. Would anyone like to speak to that?
I can touch in on that. We are acquiring and we are selling off public lands at one and the same time. And the balance of how lands are disposed of has been controversial throughout the 200 years plus of the United States since the signing of the Constitution. But the land office closed in the 1970s. Lands since that time have largely been retained and in some cases acquired, but usually where they're acquired, it's in the form of some kind of swap. There is a really significant thing that has just happened this summer. With the Great American Outdoors Act, the Land and Water Conservation Fund was permanently authorized. This fund, since the 1960s, has acquired monies through the royalties on offshore drilling and retained those receipts for the betterment of our public lands. In some cases, that's the installation of infrastructure, parking lots. In some cases, it's the purchase of conservation easements. In some cases, it's the purchase of lands. It's usually allocated through state programs. In fact, every one of the 3,000 counties in the United States has benefited from the Land and Water Conservation Fund in some form or fashion. And so sometimes those lands are purchased or easements are purchased and they become state lands or county managed lands, not necessarily federal lands, although in some cases federal. So we are acquiring more in a very targeted fashion at every level of the government for to be held in the public trust and managed for public access.
Great summary, Phil. So that's been a primer on what's going on with public lands, what we know about the history, just generally what we know about them. But I think it's time to dive in and describe some of them individually. And so it's time to come back to you, Holly. And why don't you tell us about the federal lands you've experienced in the Washington, Idaho area and what you know about them, what uses are allowed, and if you have a local or regional example, that would be nice.
So my favorite federal lands in our area consist of U.S. Forest Service, so National Forest lands. I spend a significant amount of time in the Colville National Forest, and then to a lesser extent, but still quite a bit of time up in the Idaho Panhandle National Forest. And so some of my favorite areas, last weekend, I was up on the Kettle Crest. It's a gorgeous area. It has a portion of the Pacific Northwest National Recreation Trail running through it. And then I had trips planned for this weekend up to the Salmo Priest Wilderness. Unfortunately, the weather does not appear to be cooperating for my plans, but so I spend a lot of time on Forest Service lands, and I guess some of the considerations for these areas, they are typically open to backpacking, which is one of the reasons why I love them so much. I really don't have any opportunities or very limited opportunities to backpack within Spokane County where I live. And so if I wish to go backpacking, and also if I wish to do night hiking, federal lands typically don't have hours of operations the way that Spokane County parks do. So if I want to be out late at night or early in the morning, it's really the federal lands that are the best places for me to go for that. there are areas where I love to go fishing. So I fished the Salmo River a few weeks ago, unsuccessfully, but I keep trying. And I especially enjoy my time spent in wilderness areas. And those are areas that typically have a few more restrictions on them. So I think particularly the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness over in Montana has a much smaller group size limit. So if I go to the cabinets with friends, the group size can be no more than 8 people total. If I go to the Salmo Priest Wilderness, I can have 12 people total in my group. And so there are some restrictions around the use of certain areas, and particularly for wilderness areas, those are open to hiking and equestrian uses as the main forms of recreation, not open to bicycle use. But other national forest lands are open to bicycling, and in some areas open to motorized uses, and that could be motorized summer, but also motorized winter, depending on where you're located.
Okay. What about hunting? You've talked about fishing, and I think that's usually okay most places. Hunting's not always okay everywhere, but is it in these national areas?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, national forest land is open to hunting during the designated hunting seasons. And so it depends on what season is currently open for what variety of hunting can take place there. But both wilderness and non-designated national forest lands are open to hunting as a permitted use.
Yes, for that 1 month, and then the other months that we can be out backpacking, et cetera. I know it. Well, go ahead, Phil.
There is an interesting thing on the fishing, and I'm not the expert on this by any means, but Holly's right. The hunting and fishing are generally regulated by each state. And so in terms of the national forest land, the restrictions are whatever the state employs. There is an exception to the national parks, which generally don't allow hunting, but generally do allow fishing. And some of the parks retain what's called original jurisdiction. And so they may control the regulations and permitting. So if you're going to go fishing inside a national park, find out whether you need to get the particular state permit or a national park permit or both or neither.
True. An example that I know of is Yellowstone National Park, and there you have to get a Yellowstone fishing permit, and you actually don't need another fishing license to fish there. So it is a little different. Well, moving on, do we have other federal lands that we'd like to talk about, either Holly or Phil?
One of my favorites locally for just outside of the Spokane area is Fish Trap Recreation Area, which is managed by the Bureau of Land Management. And that's one, I mean, Phil mentioned this earlier, that typically Bureau of Land Management lands are devoted to grazing, and maybe recreation isn't necessarily a primary concern, but I feel as though Fish Trap is the real exception. So this is an area where Bureau of Land Management did surveys starting about 5 years ago and developed a recreation plan for that property. And we've had a series of work parties out there that incorporate work from Washington Trails Association, the Spokane Mountaineers, Backcountry Horsemen of Washington. And we've developed a viable trail system that's in the neighborhood of about 12 miles now. And it's a fairly large area, and it's open to hiking, horseback riding, mountain biking, backpacking is a permitted use. There are day use sites, wonderful birding blind out there for those who love to watch birds. So that's one of the local BLM properties I can think of that really, while grazing is still a permitted use, and certain times of the year, there are gates on the property that absolutely have to be closed behind hikers because there are cattle running on the property as well. But all the same, recreation has kind of become a primary use for the Fish Trap area.
I think one of the wonderful things that the Bureau of Land Management offers, and it's not exclusive to them, but there are a large number of undeveloped or less developed campsites that are often free. If you just simply know they're there, and they may not consist of anything more than a place to pitch your tent, maybe a fire ring, maybe a picnic table. They may not have other facilities and services, and so they don't charge an entrance fee. And if you're car camping, driving around the West, going to and from places, and you want to have that experience, whether it's to reduce costs or to end your day at a place that's convenient or experience the solitude, there's a wealth of BLM campgrounds that are not as heavily utilized as many of the national forests or national parks.
I agree. I've stayed at one or two. Go ahead, Holly.
Well, the other BLM site that just occurred to me that's a favorite for this time of the year as we transition into winter, Mineral Ridge, that's just east of Coeur d'Alene. It has a lovely hiking trail, so really excellent use for hiking there. But my favorite is to go there in the month of December and even into early January. It's a wonderful spot to watch the bald eagles as they come into Lake Coeur d'Alene. So it's another example of a BLM site that pretty easy access to everybody in our region and really some diverse possibilities there for recreational uses.
Now we've not talked about the Army Corps of Engineers at all. And they are one of the lesser known agencies that manage lands because most typically they're managing the dams across rivers and they're competing with the Bureau of Reclamation for production of energy. And so we tend to think of them here locally, if we think of them at all, with managing the Albany Falls Dam. But they also manage areas that have mitigated the impact of that. And so real specifically, we have some remarkable campsites here at Springy Point along the what used to be the Pend Oreille River, now Lake Pend Oreille, the mud flats, and some really wonderful wildlife habitat up around the Clark Fork Delta area. And so again, we don't often think of the Army Corps. They don't manage vast tracts. They manage really specific site locations. And we may be blessed with some of the jewels in their system here locally.
I have to agree, Phil. I've stayed at a number of Army Corps campsites. There's a great one out near Libby, Montana. There are a number of them in Minnesota, and they're extremely well managed. So kudos to the Army for knowing how to manage a campsite. Great recreation areas for camping. Well, do we feel we've covered enough federal land? Shall we move on to the state, what we know about state lands, everybody? All right. So, Holly, would you like to talk about what you know about the state lands? I understand you know a little more about Washington, but it's very close to us. Tell us what you know, and we'll chime in with what we know about Idaho state lands.
Sure. Well, I've been involved with Washington State Parks for quite a while. I'm a longtime member of the Friends of Mount Spokane State Park. And so really, Mount Spokane is one of my key recreation areas, and I've been fortunate to be involved with some of the decision making that's taken place within Mount Spokane State Park over the years. And there was even a very short period of time where I worked for Mount Spokane State Park. And one of my favorite opportunities was to help give the cave tours up at Crawford State Park, which is also managed by Mount Spokane State Park. So with state parks, typically backpacking is not allowed, but most of Washington State Parks do have day hiking opportunities. They're typically open to multiple uses in terms of hiking and mountain biking, horseback riding. They have different management goals for different areas, even within the same park. So in Washington State, Mount Spokane State Park and Riverside State Park are the two largest parks in Washington. And because of their size, you can see a wide range of opportunities within the parks. So Bowl and Pitcher area is a really popular camping area within Riverside State Park. And that's an area that's definitely very recreation intensive. But at the same time, there's another portion of Riverside State Park, which is the Little Spokane River Natural Area. And a natural area within a state park is a little bit like a wilderness designation within National Forest Service. So far more restrictive in terms of what is a permitted use for that area. So specifically for the Little Spokane River area, for those who want to be doing water sports along the Little Spokane River, there's a prohibition against flotation devices. You can use a canoe or a kayak, but not an inner tube. For people who are recreating along the trail, it's permitted to hike, but not to mountain bike. Horses are not allowed there. Dogs are not allowed there. And then for Mount Spokane State Park, there's an area that's even slightly more restrictive. So there's the Ragged Ridge Natural Area Preserve. And it's very similar to a natural area, but there's also a lot of research value for that natural area preserve. So again, hiking only and no dogs allowed for those areas.
I find it interesting that the two largest state parks in the state are over here on the east side of the state when there's so much population to the west. How did that turn out?
That's a great question. And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure. I know that with Mount Spokane State Park, the history of it was Francis Cook purchased a huge holding that was close to the summit of Mount Spokane. And he was a person who lived in the Spokane area in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And he had a goal to develop it as a national park. And over time, he was able to transfer that land that he initially owned over to Washington State Parks. And then State Parks added to it through the purchase of adjacent lands that were foreclosed upon during the Great Depression. And so it became the largest state park in Washington, but I'm not quite sure why we have all of the larger parks over here in Eastern Washington. I'm just thankful that that's the case, because I mean, certainly there is the fact that public land in Spokane County is a fairly small percentage of the overall land base. And so it's a great boon to recreationists that we have these parks right here in our backyard, because otherwise we'd have even less available, and they're wonderful parks.
There you go. Let's move over to the Idaho Panhandle and state parks. The ones I'm thinking of, Phil and Holly, are smaller Round Lake State Park, which is very near Sandpoint, but just south of us we have Farragut, and at Priest River, Priest Lake, we've got wonderful state park.
Yeah, and so it's important when looking at Idaho's lands, of the figures Holly was citing earlier, the public lands comprising 70% of Idaho, it's actually about 60% that's federal. The other 10% is an amalgam of state and other things, reservations. The state lands are not all public lands. What happened at the time of Idaho's transition from territory to statehood is that, again, the United States federal government retained the federal lands, but granted to the state two sections for every township. Another way of saying that is about 3 million acres, a little over. As with most Western states' charters, Idaho's lands were to be managed for the financial benefit of the school system. This was not unique. It was common throughout the West. That's the case. So they're tasked with managing the lands for the greatest economic benefit. And most of the land managers within Idaho's Department of Lands will sometimes bristle a little bit at the description of them as being public lands. They are a different category. Over time, over the last 100 plus years, Idaho's sold off a portion of those, so that today there's only about 2.4 million acres. They've retained about two-thirds of the original allotment. And they've done that in a way that would economically benefit the school system. So Idaho's Department of Lands, in North Idaho especially, are congregated. They've swapped lands so that over the years, there's more state lands in large units up here in North Idaho and very limited scattered ones in Southern Idaho. And they're managed for timber production. They are open to recreationists, and you can find out more information about Idaho Department of Lands Recreation Program. Our listeners can go to their website. They can Google Idaho Department of Lands Recreation Program and find out all of the details about what they can and cannot do. But in general, there is very open public access on Idaho Department of Lands lands. And they sometimes have some real hidden gems. They're not particularly well developed for that purpose, though. It's not the objective in mind. Now, that said, there's a sister agency, if you will, Idaho Department of Parks and Recreation that has largely acquired lands through donation and other means that operate some of the real gems we see today. Round Lake up here, Farragut, some beautiful campsites along Priest Lake, Lion's Head, just absolutely stunning locations that, you know, we should be really proud of and cherish and enjoy. But they operate as a mandate for recreation different from the Department of Lands.
Yeah, so really two separate, in a way, two separate entities with different goals, different purposes.
Yep. Not unlike, yes. In fact, there's some broad similarities between the way that the Forest Service and the National Park Service operate differently. The Department of Lands is that agricultural commodity that the Forest Service might be, and Department of Parks and Recreation is similar to the National Park Service, where the focus really is on that user interface.
Yes, it sounds similar. Well, as we come closer to the end of our time together, we have left some local lands to talk about, and there are a few of them, particularly around the Sandpoint and Sagal area. We've got some great organizations, but we also have county parks, city parks, nature preserves, and as I said, private entities, nonprofits who manage areas that are open to the public. Let's talk about those.
Yeah, I have some favorite spots, and one of them is back to federal, but it's the Bureau of Land Management Gamblin Lake. That's a really unique place. And the county has just put in, the last year or so, a new trailhead to go up Gold Hill at the Hayes Gulch area. A fabulous facility. And of course, you know, we wouldn't be able to access that wonderful trail up Nickanick without going across City of Sandpoint property, the first 20 acres or so. And then there's the conservation proposal easement that Kinnicksu Land Trust has put in place in the Pine Street Woods that is a community forest and just a wonderful gem that we enjoy here at Sandpoint. And look at the city of Sandpoint's Park and Rec with the offerings from Lakeview Park to Traverse Park to the city beach at Sandpoint. Some wonderful facilities for not just the people who live in Sandpoint, but people who might come visit.
That's right. And north of town, there's the Wyman Preserve that folks wander around, and it's a beautiful hiking trail. No hiking trails, many, many, many miles of trails. And then, of course, McCarthy Lake is south of that, so it combines well together. Holly, do you venture over to the local lands in the Panhandle, or do you stick to Eastern Washington?
I venture over a little bit, not as often as I would like to, but in terms of Spokane County Parks, and it kind of relates back to your earlier question about are we making more public lands too. With Spokane County Parks, we have the Conservation Futures Program, which is a funding mechanism set aside to help acquire additional public lands. And so I've been really spending my time the last few years enjoying and helping to expand the trail system on some of these relatively new acquisitions to Spokane County Parks. And so examples include Mica Peak Conservation Area, which I think the county originally purchased in 2015. They added to it last year. WTA helped to build a brand new trail that we just finished as of, I think, week before last. That trail is now finished. And it connects all the way from the Mica area that's a little bit south of Spokane all the way over to Liberty Lake Regional Park. So it's a large area that's interconnected now for some longer adventures. And then Flying L Ranch was a relatively new acquisition. I believe that they haven't even had an official ribbon cutting for the parking lot yet, but it is now open and accessible to the public. And this was one that the Spokane Mountaineers really took the lead for the trail building. There was no trail at all on the property as of February of this year. And it became the COVID sanity saver for so many of the local Spokane Mountaineers members, where we had a crew leader who was setting up socially distanced work parties. And it was an area that was open even during a lot of the local shutdowns, and people were from the club were going out individually to work on this trail so that by the time we reached summer, the trail was completed and it was very far ahead of the original schedule. And it was really because everything else was shut down and some of the volunteers were just spending every spare minute out there as a way to have a little outdoor therapy when everything seemed so limited in terms of where we could go. And then a brand new one that the county just added is in addition to the Antoine Peak Conservation Area, where just earlier this week I had a meeting with County Parks and we have approved a flag line for the trail that will be built starting this fall. We've got work parties starting in November. And hopefully over the course of the next year, we will have a trail in place. And the county's goal is to have a new parking lot open for that area within the next year or so. And so a lot of times we are like, it's kind of the fun part of my job where I get the sneak peek of all of these areas that are brand new. It's not even open to the public yet, but the county always has the goal that by the time the area is open to the public and we have a parking lot, hikers have someplace to go. So we have to be working on the trails before the trailhead has even started to be in development, just so that we can have it ready to go when the public is able to access the land legally. So I guess that would be a chance to give a little shout out in case anyone is interested in the sneak peek. We do have some work parties already scheduled out there for Etter Ranch. And this is not an area that the public can access legally, except for if you're there to help us build these trails. So we'd love to have some additional volunteers as well. But Spokane County Parks is definitely growing. And so for me, that's where I'm spending a lot of my time, just because I have a lot of work projects in these areas.
And I just got to say, every time I go to Spokane Valley to get my car serviced, if it's in there any length of time, I grab a free rental and go over to the Dishman Hills and do a little hiking around there. It's just such a gem.
Phil, I was going to say the very same thing. You know, as things close down here in the Panhandle, it gets colder and snowier. There are still opportunities as we head west towards Spokane for hiking and exploring. And I believe Friends of Scotchman Peak are finished with trail projects, as are Idaho Trails Association. So it's nice that if we have gung-ho folks from Idaho who would know about working on trails and would like some extra trail work this year, they can get over to Eastern Washington.
Yeah, we would be remiss not to remind listeners that access to our public lands is something that it's important to all of us to make sure we're able to maintain. And so come out next summer, next spring, and volunteer for Washington Trails Association, Idaho Trails Association, the Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness, the Dishman Hills Friends and Conservancy. It really takes a core of volunteers to make sure these trails stay open and accessible.
Very true. Well, you know, we're getting to the end of our time, and this Community Conversations has gone longer than most, so we'll need to wrap up, but have we missed anything, Holly?
No, thank you so much for having me.
All right, then. Well, then I would like to thank listeners for tuning in to the KRFY Community Conversations, talking about Public Lands 101. I know we haven't touched on them all. Our guest has been Holly Weiler, Eastern Washington Regional Coordinator for the Washington Trails Association, and she's also a writer for Out There Magazine, which is a great magazine, by the way. So thank you all for listening today, and I hope you'll tune in next week.